Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Eduardo Duarte with co-hosts, teacher and socialist Andy Lipson, and community organizer and socialist Kenny Cepeda. We are online at what-s-left.webnode.com. Joining us today is Stephanie, a DACA recipient who will share with us her experience and views after the Supreme Court decision last Thursday that blocked Trump's attempt to end DACA or the expanded form Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals in what seemed to be in less in favor of for the DACA recipients, seemed to be an upset in a more conservative Supreme Court. And so why don't you start us off, Kenny, with your connection to Stephanie. If you could share with us how did you both meet and maybe as well.
Hi. Stephanie and I actually have become very good friends. We've had a lot of great conversations. We met through a community org that gives support to the migrant community, asylum seekers, day laborers. And so that was the initial connection. So the nature of our relationship was first political. But it's evolved to a friendship, and where Stephanie has been able to share a lot of the personal struggles and just thoughts surrounding DACA. And I've always wanted to have Stephanie on the show for that reason, to share her experience. I think, obviously, there was something significant that happened last week, something that was being dragged on by the Supreme Court. But I think it goes in line with what we've been discussing in the previous episodes before, along the lines of Black Lives Matter, social movements happening right now. Because I just initially, I think DACA derailed the massive support that immigration reform had in 2006, 2005. And then it basically changed the conversation into just talking about DACA, and we no longer talk about the whole system being reformed. So it is a divide and conquer tactic that I see from our ruling class. But more than that, I just want Stephanie to share her views and experiences surrounding this program that still will potentially be challenged again. And so I think maybe Stephanie can share some of her thoughts on this.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm a DACA recipient. And I originally got DACA in 2012. So that was 8 years ago. Actually, the 8 year anniversary of DACA was on last Tuesday, and the Supreme Court decision was on Thursday. Mm-hmm. I think again, like Kenny mentioned, it was something that that DACA recipients had anticipated, a decision that was really anticipated, but a lot of us actually didn't think that the court would rule in our favor. So now we find ourselves, sort of scrambling, because there's a lot of what ifs now. And we're kind of in a period right now where there's a lot of just waiting to see what the next steps are, because, you know, it is it was a really long written decision by the Supreme Court justices. And so, you know, there's room for interpretation. And there's also, you know, the Department of Homeland Security that's involved, the Trump administration that's involved, and USCIS that's involved when it comes to processing DACA renewals and accepting new DACA applications.
Why don't we just briefly talk about what DACA is, just for some of our listeners and viewers that may not be familiar with what DACA is. because it has prevented, at least in some estimates, about 700,000 deportations. And if you could just delve into it, it was something that was very controversial in the immigrant community. And Trump has used it almost as leverage for Congress. If you can just give us some background.
Yeah, so DACA is Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, and it was an executive order that was passed through Obama, under the Obama administration. This was, again, back in 2012. So what DACA is you get a 2-year work permit, work authorization, and then at least when I first applied, or when everyone first applied, you also got a social security number, which with or without DACA, that number is always forever yours. And so this is a renewal. This is a permit that you apply for every 2 years. And at first, I believe the fee was $465, and now it's gone up to $495. And there's talks about having it go up, I think, as far as $795. And this work permit allows me to, you know, secure employment. It has opened up in the academia world. It has opened up really good scholarship opportunities. Unfortunately, in the academia world, not all scholarships. Let me just start off by saying I didn't qualify for financial aid, FAFSA, because it's federal money. So when I was a college student, I had to apply for scholarships. And actually in California, there was this state bill that was passed, AB 540, that allowed undocumented students with or without DACA to pay in-state tuition instead of non-resident tuition. Besides that, the academia world, a lot of the requirements, at least when I was in college, they asked for you to be a DACA recipient and show the work authorization.
Let's be clear, though, Stephanie, it's not a pathway to citizenship for recipients, correct?
Correct. It's temporary, and I have a lot of my thoughts about DACA have evolved, right? Because when I first received DACA, I was 15, and now I'm 23. And I think that DACA, it's a Band-Aid. It's a Band-Aid on a much larger problem. But yeah, it's temporary, and there's currently no pathway to citizenship.
Can you say something more about who are the people who are eligible for DACA?
Yeah.
So let me kind of give a little timeline. So in 2012, it was for the guidelines were you had to be in the country for a certain amount of time, mm-hmm. and not have left the country. You had to show proof. There was like a certain age cap. I can't remember. I don't want to say the number, you know, if I'm wrong, but only a certain age range.
Right.
Go ahead.
I think the thing I see here is have unlawful presence in the United States after entering this country before their 16th birthday. And they were under the age of 31. Like born
age of 31 of June, the 15th of June of 2012.
Yeah.
So very, very.
The requirements really was targeting children, youth,
Isn't there also a requirement that you have to be getting education?
Yeah.
Or is that, am I wrong on that?
And I think you would have had to have show a high school diploma or GED, and then people in the or show that you are trying to then be admitted to a college. I think that was something else I'd read about, and that if you were in the armed forces, you could go to get a DACA. You could be under DACA, but you had to show that you had been honorably discharged.
Yeah, it was a certain amount of time in the public in school in the public education system.
Yeah.
And so that was back in 2012. And it went on, applications were processed, people were able to renew. And then in 2017, so September 5th, 2017, Trump actually rescinded DACA. That was the last, I'm sorry, I think that was the day that they announced that there was a cutoff date a little bit after that, that they weren't going to be accepting any more DACA, new DACA applications. And so that affected a lot of people. And the DACA, applications, around that time, there were about 700 to 800,000 DACA recipients in the U.S. So that was September 2017. Now we fast forward to, you know, last week, June 18th, 2020, and now we are we're sort of in the limbo. We're not sure. A lot of attorneys have came out and suggested that for those that do qualify for DACA and have never applied, they're suggesting to start collecting their documentation. But we're waiting essentially for an announcement from the Trump administration and USCIS.
I was just asking, just to clarify, as of 3 years ago, there haven't been new applicants to the program.
Correct.
And if I might just add, because I think it's an important component of the eligibility guidelines, you also, or anyone applying, must not be convicted of a felony or significant misdemeanor or three or more other misdemeanors, and do not otherwise pose a threat to national security or public safety, which seems quite vague there. What if you're a dissident? But I think that that is a crucial piece because it's very narrow for who can qualify to become a DACA recipient.
Yeah, and let me just, I want to add on to that actually, because on the application, having done the application several times now, there is a portion where it blatantly asks you, you know, have you committed a terrorist act? Have you been a member or have you been affiliated to any gangs? And sort of those questions. I think it really depends case to case because in some states, the DUI is considered a felony. And I know that there have been cases where DACA recipients, some of them have gotten a DUI. And have been successful in renewing their DACA. So I did want to say that. It really depends case to case. Yeah.
And could you talk a little bit about what your thoughts were at first, like when you first were part of this in 2012, and then maybe how your thoughts about DACA have evolved over time?
Yeah, definitely. So in 2012, like I mentioned, I was 14, turning 15, I believe. And, you know, I didn't really know about DACA until I was, you know, filling out the paperwork, the application. And I was looking at my parents' response, my parents' reactions, right? And their reactions were, you know, we're excited. This is good. You're going to be able to have a work permit. And they were under the impression that this meant a pathway to citizenship, maybe not in the near future, but down the line. That was sort of my initial thoughts. I was really young. And as time went on, I think it wasn't until I got to college in 2015 that I really started to see my thoughts on DACA started to change, right? I was referred to as a dreamer. And I'm sure that this is a word that is commonly thrown out. I did identify as a dreamer at that age. I fell into that argument of, you know, I deserve to be here. You know, I fought so hard to get a higher education, and, you know, I contribute to this economy, I pay taxes, and that's what the dreamer narrative is, right? And once I realized that, and, you know, fast forward 5 years later, 1 year out of college, and it's a band-aid. I think DACA is a band-aid, and I don't know if Obama did it on purpose. I still am trying to come to terms with that and figure that out for myself. But I think that DACA further divided the immigrant community, the immigrant rights movement, because now we're very divided within the movement, because now we have people that are, you know, fighting only for the dreamers, right? And not for the 11 million undocumented people. And so that's sort of where my mind is at now, I think that DACA is only for a certain population, and it's not enough.
So when I was in high school, in early 2000s, a lot of my friends were in high school, in school, and by the time they got off, so they qualified eventually for DACA. But we all had reservations about the limitations of the program, it seemed like a dream, and it's, you know, that's part of the narrative, but it almost seems like it's become a nightmare of sorts for some people, especially, you know, when you and I talk about waiting for a decision. Is this something that has changed within you, you know, like the optimism turned into some sort of, you know, something more heavy?
Definitely, it has, because I always thought that maybe Congress would, quote-unquote, do the right thing and turn this executive order into an actual piece of legislation. That was the rhetoric around DACA for a long, long time, and it still is. Some, you know, Congress people still think that it is. But my thoughts have really shifted and changed. And, even waiting for this Supreme Court decision was really mentally draining. And I hear the same thing from a lot of other DACA recipients that, you know, they're really playing with our lives. I still want to be, you know, positive and I'm holding on to this thin line of hope, but I ultimately am preparing for the worst because, I mean, it's been 8 years since DACA was officially created. And, you know, I think that we haven't made any progress.
Yeah, I think the thing you're talking about in terms of that division within the immigrant rights movement, I think is really important. For me, the first introduction to when there really seemed to be a major challenge that could have offered what was like legalization for all, amnesty for everyone, was back in the 2006 demonstrations, the Day Without an Immigrant. There was like 200,000 in San Francisco and millions across the country. And it was that movement and that sentiment where it wasn't about trying to find something just for a few people. There was a sentiment within that movement that everyone did this work. It wasn't just about good immigrants versus those bad immigrants, which they really use the DACA, they hold the DACA recipients up as this model immigrant, implying that the other people are not and somehow not deserving. Also financially and fiscally, a lot of illegal immigrants pay in taxes and don't get to see anything. So there's just so many misunderstandings about things that are said about illegal immigrants or people without papers. So I am wondering, like, were you aware, or you kind of spoke to it a little bit, but can you say more about how you think this might be divisive?
We're talking about the good immigrant versus bad immigrant rhetoric.
Yeah, and even the dreamer narrative.
That word dreamer, again, is being constantly used and thrown around. And I think it doesn't help that a lot of DACA recipients identify as that. And they keep adding fuel to that. And a lot of them... I have seen photos when, you know, they go out and do actions or protests, and I see that their very famous prop is a graduation cap. And I think that's problematic. I think it's super problematic. And because, you know, not everyone that comes to this country, or not everyone that's an undocumented immigrant in this country, wants to study, and that's fine. That's okay. These are just my beliefs. And not everyone that is an undocumented immigrant in this country, you know, wants to be an extraordinary, you know, neurosurgeon, right? And I think that's what, again, this dreamer narrative paints a lot of good immigrants as. And it's really harmful. You know, within, again, the immigrant community, creating a lot of division, and now we're just pointing fingers. That's really where we're at now. At least that's what it feels like, that, you know, I deserve to be here and you don't deserve to be here. And, you know, we only want you, again, when people try to defend undocumented immigrants in general, they use the... their contribution to the economy as a argument, which is true. You know, undocumented immigrants do pay taxes, and you know, but again, why is it that we only are looking at valuing human lives through their labor?
And I should say, Stephanie, you would agree, wouldn't you, about how you said something around, well, you said not everyone is here to study. And many of our essential workers currently during this pandemic are not necessarily folks that have an educational background. So, I mean, this is what essential workers do. They are the backbone of the society that makes it work. So that even that argument is it doesn't hold. It's still yet... As you were saying, I agree with you in the sense that it doesn't even have to be about labor, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. So something that I sticks in my mind when around the time of DACA 2012 is that the Obama himself. There are plenty of videos in where he introduced DACA and use the phrase through no fault of their own. I don't know if you have any thoughts about this and maybe talk about what you think the implications of that phrasing, that framing have.
Yeah, no, for sure. So yeah, I've heard that over and over again. And I, you know, I've even been in dialogues with people that, that again justify that I deserve to be here and stay in this country because, you know, it wasn't my fault. I didn't consent. I was too young. I was a child, etc. I've heard it all. And I, you know, again, I think it causes a lot of harm because it's painting out the parents of these DACA recipients as the and, you know, the bad immigrants, they're criminalizing them and dehumanizing them. Yeah, I have heard that over and over again. And again, I just think it's problematic, it's harmful, and I think it's created a further divide with immigrant rights and again the movement of us really trying to all get into the same page.
It seems to me that it's bittersweet, right, for DACA recipients, because I've heard it in different conversations with you and with other people, that in the immigrant community, it has created mixed status families, right? So, you know,
correct.
Some people are getting, you know, some benefits, and while other people in the community don't get anything. And they just have to watch. And so I don't know, do you have any thoughts about this?
We are a mixed status family. My brother was born in the country. So he was, you know, he is a U.S. citizen. And then you have, you know, me as a DACA recipient, and then you have, you know, our parents undocumented. And so, yeah, there's a lot of mixed status families that I am, that I know of, you know, friends, family, and it's crappy. It's really crappy.
You had kind of mentioned that you were like, well, what was Obama up to? When he kind of proposed this, because I mean, we've on this show we've talked about how he was the deporter in chief.
Yeah.
He was officially deported more people, and really kind of made it about saying no. Well, it wasn't so much about deporting people. He was like, I was finding those people here who were here criminally, you know, and I was going to give them this due process and then have them sent back. And but then people were very disappointed, you know, in Obama, and this was his kind of his last act before he stepped off, you know, after he was no longer president. It was this executive order. And people gave him credit for that. People said, well, at least he gave us this. In light of your thoughts about this, what do you make of it? What he was doing? I'll ask that first.
You know, it's been 8 years, so I definitely have had different opinions, and where I stand now, again, I don't know if he did it, if he knew what he was doing, in the sense that, yes, he did this executive order, he made it happen, and yes, it gave me gave me benefits, but again, very short-term benefits, not just for me, but for a bunch of people, and again, we're in this limbo, and so I don't know. I think that maybe Obama did it on purpose to get that immigration reform rhetoric out of, you know, of society, because it was for a very long time. And like, it looked like we were going in the direction of possibly getting an immigration amnesty or immigration reform prior to DACA. And I think after DACA, we settled, and I think that's kind of where a lot of people's feelings are now, where we're ready to not settle anymore. And so, yeah, I think Obama, I don't know if he did it on purpose to move away from that immigration reform rhetoric, or he genuinely wanted to, you know, help the youth and further criminalize the parents. I'm not sure. Yeah.
You know, Stephanie, right now, Donald Trump seems to be the one with the face of evil in the immigration community. But as you're talking and having gone through your experience and up to now, it's clear that he just picked up the thread from a previous administration. And so I was wondering if we could go into whether the Democrats or the Republicans are one or the other are any hope for the immigrants community.
I do agree with that statement that Trump did pick up, continue that thread from Obama. And I think I do want to make that a point that a lot of people in the immigrant community and the immigrant rights movement claim that, you know, Trump initiated all of this and, you know, Trump's deporting a lot of people. But yes, Obama, that was his nickname, deporter in chief. To your point of Democrats or Republicans, from what I've seen, and I try to stay away from the news because there's just too much background noise. But from what I've read and from what I'm informed and, you know, the research I've done, I think that it looks like the Democrats and Republicans want to get together and do create a piece of legislation only for the youth, for DACA recipients. And that's where a lot of us are not willing to settle, because we want it to be inclusive of all undocumented people in the country, and not just the youth, the DACA recipients. So it looks like that the focus right now is on the youth, on the children, and we're not children anymore.
And I'm also of an immigrant community myself. I have a mixed status family, and I'm a border child, and so I sometimes in our community we speak about the lesser of two evils. Well, he is better than this, or this president is worse than the previous administration, or that's how we speak about it in our communities, and that is almost giving the excuse or allows. Justify sometimes the actions of the Democrats, because sometimes our immigrant community seems to embrace the Democrats more than the Republicans. And I don't know that if, I guess what I was trying to get with this, I don't know if you find that problematic, because as you said, we settle for less. Do us, the immigrant community, have any hope in the Democrats?
Yeah, no, I agree, and I have seen it, and I have been a person that has fell into that. You know, the lesser evil of the two. And I no longer think that way. Because I do see that often in the movement, you know, friends and family and especially right now with this campaign, right, this presidential election, everyone that is a DACA recipient is rooting for, you know, the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party is supposedly going to, you know, pave the way for immigrant rights in this country. But I don't buy it. I really don't.
Yeah. It seems to me that, again, I'm also part of a mixed status family. My dad was deported many years ago. He came here as a refugee. To throw it out there, I think a lot of us in the community are actually are part of this weird thing, you know, where some of us have freedoms that others don't. So, yeah, there's a kind of bittersweet. But my point is that I think that is a huge mistake that happens on the left overall, especially people that know immigration on the surface, that and especially people that have come to the struggle, you know, for immigrant rights recently under Trump, they seem to think that his rhetoric is the most damaging. When we look at the body of work of Democrats and Republicans for the last 20, 30 years since NAFTA especially, the Democrats have actually escalated things. And it almost seems like the Republicans have just followed the thread and also escalated. And I'm not saying by any means vote Republican, hell no. But the reality, if we're being honest, Democrats are at war with immigrant people and working people overall. You know, I think some people that listen to the show kind of have an idea where we stand with open borders, which might lead us to a question later. But yeah, I just wanted to throw that out there that yes, if you're getting into the immigration fights, the Democrats are not friends of immigrants. They may be nicer in rhetoric, but like you said, they are using DACA, at least in my view, as political football. And in reality, they're just tossing it around without necessarily providing a path to resolving things. So it doesn't seem that way, which I actually wanted to talk about earlier about the challenge of the Supreme Court. What was the challenge? What was the premise of the fight in court? Can you speak to that?
We had DACA rescinded in September 5th, 2017, and you know, that was essentially blocked through the lower courts, and eventually made its way up to the Supreme Court. And the reason that the Supreme Court, you know, took a look at it and decided to take on the case was because, again, the question of, you know, whether Trump did this, the Trump administration did this following the procedure, right? And if it was constitutionally correct. And so you have, you know, several DACA recipients along with, you know, an org and different attorneys, you know, fight against it. And from what I've read, a lot of the arguments, especially recently because of COVID, a lot of the justifications for continuing DACA was because we need the DACA recipients that are healthcare workers to continue working because, you know, we're fighting this pandemic. And we need, you know, DACA recipients that are currently essential workers to continue working. So if you were to, you know, take away DACA, then that means you lose a huge portion of the economy. I don't know the numbers, but yeah, essentially that was one of the arguments, one of the recent, I think that was submitted sometime in April to the Supreme Court.
I mean, it brings it back to economic value and what, you know, what a worker is able to contribute to the country. And that's kind of what it seems, even at the Supreme Court that is supposed to be a objective body, you know, there is an economic value put to each body. Obviously, DACA could be challenged again, right, by the Trump or any administration. Basically, the DACA is not out of the woods yet, right? Yes, yeah. The petition was made, but it can still be challenged by this administration or another administration. And yeah.
Yeah, so that's exactly where we're at now. So in the decision, pretty much and I, you know, I looked into it because I was very curious because I studied this in college and I was very curious as to the decision, right? And so it was 5-4, the ruling, and the person who pretty much broke the tie was Chief Justice Roberts. Which was like, we kind of saw that coming, kind of didn't, but pretty much in the DACA decision, in the Supreme Court decision, in the opinion, he pretty much wrote out to Trump, to the administration, this is why I'm voting this way, because you didn't follow the procedure. And this is how you can rescind DACA procedurally and be successful. So in the opinion, he literally laid out for the administration how to do it, how to officially end DACA. So yes, the Trump administration can do that. That's where we're at. We know that, you know, attorneys have came out and said that it's going to be a process. It's not an overnight thing. It's a process. It's a procedural thing. And so it's going to be a couple of months until we actually see that successfully happen through the Trump administration. And I do want to add, that is another sort of thing up in the air again, is why, going back to the comment that Eduardo said about Democrats and Republicans, that's sort of why a lot of people are hoping that we get a Democrat into office and not Trump, because, you know, there's this promise, right, that Biden is saying that he will not rescind DACA, and on the contrary, that he will create some sort of legislation through Congress that will be permanent for DACA recipients. And so, but yes, to answer your question, yes, any administration can come in and officially take it away.
And what do you think of Biden's promise there?
I don't believe it. I think a lot, we see it, we've seen it back to back, I think, with very, like, false hope. You know, these false promises that are thrown out left and right. And I think it's to get voters, mm-hmm. and get elected. But no, I don't believe it. I don't.
Yeah, and I also think to talk a little bit about the Supreme Court is used often, particularly during election season, to talk
yep.
about the existential reason you must vote for a Democrat, because Supreme Court justices and things like that. And now we've seen Trump has put in Gorsuch, he put in Kavanaugh, and we've seen the Supreme Court's rule in favor of LGBT community only a few months ago, or maybe a month ago, and now seemingly in favor of the immigrant community. Although, like you said, I think DACA is as much a weapon used to divide that community, and it doesn't really provide any pathway to citizenship for even that small group. I'm going to ask you why you think the Supreme Court ruled in favor, because I believe that the Supreme Court was very nervous in light of the demonstrations currently taking place around racism against African American, you know, people in this country, about the idea of now taking on another group and saying, no, you don't have citizens. Now we're going to take this last crumb away from you. So I do think that Supreme Court, I always said the Supreme Court is much more responsive to pressure from below than whatever the machinations of a Democrat or Republican put in place. So I think that the Supreme Court justices were nervous about really seeming to put the screws to another, you know, group that's experiencing racism in this country, and the outrage that would come from that.
Yeah, I do agree that I agree with that. I agree that that was an influence. That was an influence to the justices. However, well, let me add on to that that we had been expecting a decision as early as, I think, was it March or April, and as late as the end of June. And so, you know, George Floyd's murder was at the end of May, and this is a conversation I actually had with Kenny and other friends, that I along with other people thought that if they ruled against DACA, that it would definitely be an uprising of the immigrant rights movement, and, you know, that it would fuel the protests and fuel the quote-unquote looting. And so, yeah, I think they were pressured. I think they were feeling that pressure from a lot of people. And so, I think that was definitely an influence in some way.
Luis Cortez is one of the lawyers who defended DACA at the Supreme Court, says that the key to the victory was able to share the stories of DACA recipients. And that's what probably moved Chief Justice Roberts. It was listening to those stories. And I should mention that Luis Cortez is also a DACA recipient himself, who was one of those lawyers in the Supreme Court. if we could just we kind of briefly just here and there, you and I and Kenny said that we're all from immigrant families. If you could just take us to who you are as an individual, but also like your family, like your story. What is your story? I think we're talking about politics here, but just if you want to share with us your personal journey, I would like to know where you're from or anything. I think that is something that moves people, especially when we talk about politics. Oftentimes we forget that behind all of this debate and behind all of this rhetoric, there are real lives. People's lives are behind all of this. I mean, immigrants aren't a monolith. Kenny, I, and yourself, we don't share the same experiences. My family has access to coming to this country that other families don't, and other family members of mine cannot come here. And I was able to go to go to school in Mexico and go to school here in the USA. And Kenny has his father, as he said right now, who was a refugee. And I mean, we're just not a monolith as immigrant families, people. So if you want to share who you are, I would love to hear your story.
Yeah, and let me just, I want to say a disclaimer. I'm comfortable sharing. I just, especially because I don't know who will be watching, right? But I don't want to, I don't want people to, again, put me into that dreamer rhetoric, dreamer narrative. So that's just my disclaimer, you know. I know that everyone has different backgrounds, different life stories, but this is just mine. And again, people do it, I think, on purpose. But yeah. So before I was born, my parents had obtained tourist visas. And so they had entered the country before I was even a part of their lives. And they decided to go back to Mexico. I was born in Mexico. And then at a few months old, the three of us came into the country. And so I didn't grow up in Mexico. Because of the tourist visa, I was able to visit when I was a little bit older. But even going, I must have been 8 years old, around that age, and even going it felt like a foreign land to me, even though that was my birthplace. And you can tell, you could tell, people could tell that I was, not from there. And, I grew up in Southern California and, my parents were they instilled in me from a very young age that education was the way, and that, I think they painted education as liberation, as the salvation to my status. And so I was a good student. I worked hard, got good grades, applied to college. And even then, applying to college was such a very difficult thing to navigate as an undocumented person. And I did go to a predominantly white high school, and I even had a very weird, uncomfortable conversation or discouraging conversation with one of my counselors where I said, you know, I'm a DACA recipient, I'm undocumented, I don't qualify for FAFSA, what do I do? And I was not pointed into any direction. So that was difficult to navigate. But I attended Cal State Long Beach. I got my bachelor's degree in political science, minor in communication studies, last year. And, decided to move my life to Northern California, to the Bay Area. I work at a law firm. It's a personal injury law firm. And I am still trying to figure out what my next steps are, but I do plan on going to law school. I'm currently in my law school application process, you know, studying for the LSAT and all that. But yeah, that's how I got here to the Bay Area. I don't know if that gives you kind of a broad layout. If you have questions, go ahead by all means.
I do have a question.
Yeah.
You mentioned that in your story right now that your parents sold education as a tool of liberation. What are your thoughts on that now?
Yeah, so now I think that I don't think that's true, necessarily true. For example, I graduated last year in May of 2019. And, you know, a month later, I packed my stuff, moved my whole life over to here, to the Bay Area. And I am now a full-time worker, right? 40 hours a week. And I no longer have that student identity. And so, and I have been working throughout college, just not full time, right? And so, I realized that, you know, even after college, right, I started to make more money, with a bachelor's degree, but it didn't solve all my problems. You know, it's, I'm still struggling. It didn't cure everything. I'm still undocumented, still have DACA. And also I do want to add on to that. Cause I hope for the viewers that I don't make it seem like citizenship is the goal or that citizenship is liberation, because it's not. And I think that's something we often in the immigrant community, and I will take full responsibility for that, where I've bought into that I think that citizenship is going to, you know, help everything and be my goal and my solution and liberation. And that's not true.
And maybe that would be a good time to ask some bigger questions. What would you like to see done with regards to, we have immigration and for people who are undocumented, what do you think would be the right outcome? That one is one that you would say, no, now we have something that's either fair or now we have something that's just. And I'll probably have a similar question about, what for you is liberation then? You know, if education isn't that, what is? You know, so that's sort of, those are two big questions, but I'm kind of curious how you'd answer them.
I think they intertwine, right? Because to me, liberation is open borders, and liberation is not reform. Liberation is citizenship for all. And so I would like to see not an immigration reform or comprehensive, whatever the rhetoric is now, but I'd like to see a solution where it's inclusive of all peoples. Citizenship for all. I don't have all the answers, right? Because even then I can say that, I can sit here and say, you know, open the borders and, you know, we don't want a wall and all of that. But I don't have necessarily an action plan and the steps on how to achieve that. Mm-hmm. Not just yet.
Yeah. About the second part, Dixon asked, what is liberation for you?
So on a smaller scale, like personal, right? Because I am a believer that transformation starts within. And so I think for me, ideally liberation is not feeling like I like my life is in the hands of other people, right? And I think to a certain degree, a lot of our lives are in other people's hands, right? Like lawmakers and you know, Congress people. But ultimately, I feel like, you know, you have the presidential administration just kind of hanging on to us like, okay, what do we do next, right? How do we mess with them? And also, again, the Supreme Court justices, you know, that was, again, very difficult for a lot of us mentally, you know, brought a lot of feelings and anxiety and fear. So I think to me, liberation looks like not having to feel like my life is in the hands of other people.
And you're in control of it.
Yeah.
I think you used a big word there that we use a lot here. You mentioned not reform. And we often talk about that here when we have some of our debates about reform and revolution. What are your thoughts on the prospects for revolution? And what do you think that would look like?
In order for revolution to get started, we need people to be on the same page, right? And meet halfway. And I think that was something that I couldn't see maybe a couple of months ago, where, you know, I would have conversations with people and, you know, I felt like it was always the Olympics oppression Olympics. And so I think that in order for revolution to happen and to get started, I think that people need to be at some point on the same page, right? Because we all have different I've had this conversation, I think, with Kenny, that I do believe in intersectionality. And I'm still struggling with that revolution, because I think when it comes to revolution, we all have one thing in common, and it's that we're workers, right? And so, I think everyone needs to get on the same page. It's difficult, for sure, because not everyone believes in the same common goal.
And can you say something about what's important to you about the ideas of intersectionality? Because I agree with you that we are all going to have to understand each other as workers and having a common goal of fighting for liberation as workers. So what for you is important about the ideas of intersectionality and what they might bring to the struggle?
Yeah, I think that when it comes to intersectionality, I think what I think is important is that, you know, there's different layers and different identities that intertwine. And at least for me personally, right, I'm a woman, I'm undocumented, I am Latina, I identify as Latina. There's just a lot of layers to that. And I think that all of those lived experiences that, you know, that I can say that I've had bring something to the movement. I think if I could kind of condense it, I think I would say that it's frustration and anger and the will of wanting to see things change. Things move, and destroying, at least in my eyes, my beliefs, destroying certain systems in this country. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, maybe the one question I would want to ask, and maybe they're tied together, is where do you see, what do you see happening in the immigration debates, if you want to put it that way? especially surrounding a looming financial crisis. If you can share any thoughts.
I think undocumented immigrants are going to be used again as that token, that the token of they're here because they want to work and they're doing the jobs that, you know, you don't want to do, and they're fueling the economy. And I think some people might argue that we need them to survive this COVID pandemic, and so forth. And so, that argument that a lot of people that are in favor of undocumented immigrants to stay in this country, that they're a great contribution to the economy. So that's what I foresee. Like, if there's any debates, I think that would be the main focus, that we're great for the economy, and not necessarily focusing on human lives, right? And focusing on why undocumented immigrants are even in this country to begin with, mm-hmm. and have left their birthplace.
I have another question for you, and this is sort of, if maybe we can wrap up around this question, and it's around the current issues with the Black Lives Movement. I'm very curious from your point of view. You know, in our communities, in the immigration community, especially in the Latino community, there is a anti-blackness sentiment that isn't oftentimes talked about in the larger conversations. And I know, being Mexican myself, just how much Afro-Mexicanos are not recognized in Mexico, in Guerrero, or at the border of Belize, or even in Veracruz. So if you can just speak to anything about the Black Lives Matter movement currently, that would just any thoughts on it?
Yeah, I do. And I want to actually say thank you for bringing that up, because you're on point when you say that that in the immigrant community, Black lives are often not mentioned. And there are Black immigrants, and immigration is a Black issue, and we often don't focus on that. And so when it comes to the Black Lives Matter movement and for example DACA, and just the immigrant rights movement, I think it intertwines, in the sense that we're experiencing oppression from the same systems in different degrees. That's my belief. But it all intertwines, right? Prisons, the prison industrial complex system, and police, and prison labor, and racism, and microaggressions. But I think something, touching up on what you said, that Mexicans don't fail at acknowledging Black lives. I think that it should be about solidarity, and we forget that. And even then, when it comes to protests, I've seen a lot of signs that unfortunately say brown lives for black, the Black Lives Matter movement, or Latinos or Latinx for the Black Lives Matter movement. And, you know, I think it's disrespectful, because we, immigration is a Black issue, and we often don't focus on that. You know, the narrative is, oh, this Mexican girl, you know, and super white passing Mexican girl and is undocumented. And so, yeah, I think that's what I'll say, that I think it's about solidarity, and we often forget that, that, you know, we, again, we have, we experience oppression from the same systems, just in different levels, but they're all intertwined.
I think it's very important for us as Latinos to go and delve into our own communities and talk about the anti-Blackness that exists and is very pervasive. I know in my family, I've heard many times growing up about los morenos o ese negro. It's very common, and I think we need to tackle those racist ideas. I think a lot of times within the POC communities, people of color communities, we often think that we cannot be racist because we're people of color. But racism can prevail. I know in Mexico, that's where I'm from, there has been African immigrants coming in from Ecuador, going traversing the entire Central America towards Mexico and Chiapas. And they're right now in immigration detention centers that are horrible. And Mexicans are doing the work of this U.S. imperialist country in keeping those people in those detention centers, which are really horrific, and saying very racist things that have been circulating the internet about Black people and calling them all kinds of racist names. These are by my own people, by Mexican people. So I think it's very important to talk to our communities about this very challenging conversations and confront it. It's not fun. I don't know. So anyhow, thank you for sharing with me, unless you wanted to say more to that.
Just to add on, I agree. I definitely agree. A lot of anti-Blackness in my own family, extended family. And again, growing up, a lot of colorism and just comments left and right. And so I agree. It's always important to have those dialogues, even pre George Floyd's murder. It's uncomfortable, but I think those conversations need to be had. Those conversations need to happen. And I think dialogue is very important. So, yeah.
Well, I definitely appreciate you taking this time, Stephanie, because I do think this question of immigration is going to become a big issue as unemployment goes up in this country, and that unemployment gets blamed. I do believe that immigrants are going to take the brunt of the blame for that issue. And then this question of circling the wagons just around DACA recipients as a salve to immigration is going to become a big issue for people trying to fight for the right thing. And I believe that the fact that you're willing to come here and talk as a DACA recipient and say, no, it's not good enough that just I get protected, because there's no protection for just one person. It's all of us or none of us. And I really think that's a really important thing, because they will continue to use these divide and conquer tactics. They do it in unions. They give better things for some sets of educators, then paraprofessionals get crap, and then they call that moving forward, and it's not. It's actually the working class falling backwards. So I just feel like your willingness to speak about this and speak about it in this way, I think, is really important.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming on here.
Thanks for inviting me. This is great. Obviously, I have a lot to say.
Yeah. An hour and 22 minutes.
Wow. But I hope I answered your questions.
You know, if you feel like anything that is compromising, so please.
I put a lot on the internet. This doesn't have to be, you know, on or whatever. It doesn't matter. I will say it's cliche, but I am undocumented and unafraid. Like, I have an Instagram and my social medias. I even go as far as tagging Trump and tagging Homeland Security, and and everything's on there. You know, everything's on there. I don't use my last name anymore on certain platforms. I cover parents' faces sometimes, and you know, you get it. But I'm not too worried. Even if this video happens to go viral, bring it on.
All right. Thank you, Stephanie, for joining us to have this conversation. It was truly, it's a gem to have you here. I mean, you really talked about a lot of things,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't actually expect our conversation to go this, to go into so many other areas.
Thank you.
All right, so that does it for this week's episode. What's Left is a weekly political podcast that's channel challenging the mainstream left. We post information about our topics and our guests on the episode notes, wherever you found this episode, or on our blog at what-s-left.webnode.com. You can find past episodes of this podcast's channel there and connect with us. I remind folks that if you like anything that you've heard here, please share your favorite episode, rate, review, and subscribe to any of our 5 platforms on iTunes Podcast, Stitcher, Google Play, BitChute, or YouTube. And now we are on Spotify. So it's actually not 5 platforms, it's 6, right? Sorry about that. I'm still trying to get used to that. So check us out on Spotify as well. And if you would like to give us feedback about something you've heard or suggest something for us to cover, contact us through our blog. I'm Eduardo Varca with co-hosts Andy Lipson and Kenny Cepeda. Thank you again, Stephanie. And that does it. Stay safe, and we'll see you all next time. Ciao.